I'm really here on false pretenses because, you know, my visit to Austin Riggs was about 60 years ago, and my memory was never good. In fact, it was always bad, and it's not been getting better. So I had to consult my first wife, and who was with me here at that time, and you know, she enriched my memories with hers. So let me tell you a bit about Dr. Rappaport, and you know, I haven't really prepared systematic things. I'll just tell you stories, and then you know, if you ask questions, you may be able to prompt me, and I'll tell you some more. I was an undergraduate in Israel at Hebrew University, and at the time, the chairman of the psychology department had been killed in 1948 during the war, and so there was no chair, and in fact the psychology department barely existed. And so the university tried to bring in several people who were candidates and who might possibly settle in Israel and lead the department. And David Rappaport considered it. And he came to Israel. I was then an undergraduate, and you know, we met. He must have liked me, I suppose. And he sort of became a long-distance mentor to me. And I came to graduate school a few years later. I went to Berkeley, but I was in touch with him. I have actually, I barely, rarely keep anything, but I did find a letter from David Rappaport, written after my first semester at Berkeley. I evidently wrote to tell him what I was doing, what I had done, and he wrote me a lot of very wise advice. And then he invited me to come here, and we came for a summer. And now I'll just tell you what it was like. So in the cemetery, there is a small building. I have a vague memory of it, but it's a two-story building, and it's right really in the middle of the cemetery, and that's where we spent the summer. And we arrived late at night, and David Rappaport had done the shopping for us and prepared some food, and he brought us to the place, and we went there, and the next morning when we got up and looked out the window, we were surrounded by graves. And then I spent about 2 months here, and I'll tell you a few, you know, a bit of what it was like. Rappaport was really an odd sort of person, you know. It was really like no one else in some ways. He was really not American. He was very European. He spoke English very precisely. He was precise in everything and careful in everything. And really every utterance of his was reflective. He had thought about everything very, very carefully. And that's the impression that he gave. Every word was precious. Every word was considered. He was a person of few words. Very, very impressive to a young man like me. So I was around him quite a bit during those 2 months. And there was a seminar going that actually, there were three or four of us that I remember. One of them, I don't know if you have met Peter Schiller. Has Peter Schiller been here? Peter Schiller, so David Rappaport was a student of a psychologist named Schiller. And he was very loyal to Schiller's memory. And Schiller's son, Peter, was there. He was about my age, and he later was a professor of psychology at MIT. and psychology and neuroscience. So he was there, and there was another young man, and neither my first wife nor I can remember his name, who was also a protege of Rapoport, all of, you know, the three of us sort of were. And we, like many other people, I suppose, had the experience of studying the seventh chapter of the interpretation of dreams. And that was a unique experience. You know, I haven't been to a yeshiva, a place, you know, an institution of higher learning for Jews where you study the Talmud, but it was clearly the closest thing that you could get to it, because we read that text, and it's not merely read that text. We knew every word of that text. We virtually memorized it, and we would discuss every word and every nuance of it. And there was a sense of religious adherence to this. It was a spiritual and a religious experience too. And Rapoport was, you know, there was that odd mixture of a very autonomous mind, very original, you know, and at the same time the devotion to the Freudian origin. And that there was really a religious element to it. So every word of the seventh chapter was to be taken very seriously. I don't want to, you know, to. And I know that I'm not the only one here, you know, who's had that experience with the seventh chapter. I should add that about 13 years later, in 1972-3, I wrote a book, my first book, called Attention and Effort. And when I was writing the acknowledgments to the book, I discovered that I had actually written something that was strongly influenced by the seventh chapter. It turned out that I had a theory of effort and how effort is allocated to different things and how the allocation of effort influences various functions, and part of it is automatic and part of it is controlled, and I had, you know, I didn't think of it until I remember writing the acknowledgments, and then I added that belatedly to the acknowledgement. So clearly that experience, you know, was quite a deep experience. Rapoport's attitude to psychology and to academic psychology was very mixed. There were people that he couldn't stand. And of course, one of the people he really minded, who was actually is a lifelong hero to me, is Paul Meehl. And Paul Meehl, in 1954, published a little book, the famous little book on clinical and actuarial prediction, which claimed, you know, that you can defeat clinical intuition by very simple combination of data. We can discuss this later. I feel this is a topic I know quite a bit about. Meehl was absolutely right, but Rapoport could not stand it. I mean, this was really a deep insult to him, that clinical judgment could be questioned and could be beaten at, you know, in a sort of cheap competition by stupid rules. This was something that he resented quite a bit. Altogether, he was very suspicious, I think, of scientific clinical psychology. But Meehl was a particular, he really minded that. In other ways, he was very open to psychology. He was interested in learning and the kind of learning that was going on at the time. And he brought in, he was interested in perception. During the 2 months that I was here, he brought in several guests. He brought in Richard Held, who is a famous psychologist, a student of perception at MIT. He brought in Irv Rock, who was a colleague of Morris and a friend, and later a colleague of mine at Berkeley. And these people would spend, the guests would be, they were guests of a very small group. There were never more than 8 or 10, you know, 8 people in the room. And they were subjected to a grilling, you know, by Rappaport. And to be grilled by Rappaport was quite something. He knew a lot. And you really had the sense that you were being evaluated and that you were being judged, and that if you made a mistake, it would be noted. And he gave that feeling, I'm sure, to all the guests who came. It was quite intimidating that way, just the formidable intellect. And he didn't smile very much. You know, there was something very severe. He was very kind. He was a very kind, extraordinarily kind and generous to me, certainly. But there was something austere and severe and deeply committed and deeply serious. He was not an American academic. There was no, you couldn't make a mistake about that. And the attitude, now Austin Riggs as a place was, I don't know what it's like today, but at that time it was a place where the people, the patients, were young people of typically of very wealthy families. And I think there was sort of a theory that they were third generation of people who had made it big, and then their parents had been, you know, the parents of very rich people, of very successful people, and then they were the third generation of it. I remember that was roughly the idea that we got about the patients. And the place was, it was beautifully run. In terms of, you know, the level of care, and there was an institution that made something about it, made a lifelong impression on me that I'll tell you about. I don't know if it goes on. And it was that every Friday morning there would be a case study, a case would be presented. And it would be an evaluation, typically done after someone had been here for a couple of months, and a decision would be made about the future treatment, and everybody participated. And a booklet was handed in the night before, where everyone who had had formal encounters with that young patient wrote their impressions. And I mean the people, just about everyone, the people who did physical therapy, as well as the psychologists, the psychiatrists, the social workers. It was quite a detailed booklet. And there was a very detailed discussion of the material, and then they would bring in the young person to be interviewed by the group. And you can, I don't know if you can imagine what it was like, but to be interviewed by Eric Erickson, who was here, and by Robert Knight, who was, you know, and by David Rappaport, although David did not ask all that many questions, but you know, when he asked, I remember Eric Erickson being actually quite active in those conversations, and then the patient would go away and the discussion would resume, and an interpretation would, and there would be very rich interpretations of what the story was in the reports and what the patient had said in the interview. And the occasion that has stayed in my mind since then was a Friday morning where a young woman was the patient, and she killed herself that night. And so on Thursday evening, we all got the report, and by Friday morning she was dead. And they had the case conference, which I remember being very impressed by sort of, there was something very brave about it, you know, and they wanted to be open, and they wanted really to understand what had gone on. And there was what looked like a remarkably honest discussion of what happened, colored by what I later studied as a hindsight phenomenon. That, you know, it seemed in retrospect that there had been signs, everywhere there had been signs of what that woman intended to do. I remember being particularly impressed by the fact that she had looked relieved and sort of happy during the last 48 hours, and people, you know, were commenting on the fact that she had decided and was therefore relieved of the power of hindsight. That has remained with me and is really a formative experience in my intellectual life as well, but as a demonstration of, I thought, organizational courage, the way that this was run, and, you know, the way that people spoke openly and really without casting blame on anyone, but everybody felt responsible. It was really quite an experience. What else would I have to tell you about what Austin Riggs was like? Not much, really. I've told you my major impressions. I don't know if I have conveyed I didn't have a very precise sense of where Rappaport was vis-a-vis psychoanalysis and, you know, the other. But there was clearly a mix of that religious reverence for the old text, and at the same time, this was the birth of ego psychology. And it was clearly not quite a heretical, but, you know, there was some rebellion about it against, you know, the psychoanalytic establishment, and Rappaport was very much involved in that, and he wanted to maintain contact with psychology, with academic psychology. That's why those guests were invited, and I think George Klein and his group, Holt and others at NYU, were close to the enterprise, and they were close, I think, quite close, all of them, to Rappaport. Whether Rappaport were the leader, the intellectual leader of the group, I had the impression he was, but I didn't see. I can't really tell you much about it. I'm sure that other people here know more than I do. On the way here, I was telling more stories, and among other stories, I was telling the story of Erik Erikson. And there was between, I think that Rappaport and Erikson were the dominant figures at Riggs, intellectually the dominant figures. And I think they were quite different. I had no inkling of what Rappaport thought of Erikson. I think that Erikson, in a way, he was less religious than the others. He was, you know, in his heart, I think he was past religion. And so there was some irony in his attitude to Rappaport. But at the same time, when he in those conversations about patients in the case conferences, he was very analytic in his orientation, and certainly he was talking about dreams no less than anyone else. And in fact, as I was telling Morris on the way here, I remember being invited by Eric Erickson to have dinner, which was an honor. And I remember him telling us on that occasion a sentence that stayed with me for 60 years. And the sentence was, if my patients don't dream of God within the first 2 weeks of treatment, something is going wrong. And you know, that's it made quite an impression on me. So they were, within the context of Austin Riggs, they seemed to be bigger than life, both the two of them, in very different ways. So Rappaport was not a comfortable man. He was really, he didn't look comfortable with himself. He didn't look comfortable with his surroundings. He was tightly controlled. And, yeah, that impression of tension, you never felt completely comfortable with Rappaport. There was not, you know, he was not a relaxed man. And Eric Erickson was very different. You know, much more oriented, much more open to people, and with more. Now, I think Rappaport did have a sense of humor, but it certainly did. And occasionally, you know, he would come up with witticisms, or you know, tell a joke with which made a very precise point. But he didn't seem to enjoy himself in life nearly as much as Eric Erickson did, and that's a clear memory that I have. I really wanted more after 2 months of that. I mean, as I wrote really in my autobiography, those 2 months were in a way the most stimulating and exciting of my graduate career, although they had nothing to do with my graduate career. We were planning experiments with Rappaport. He was, you know, cathexis, memory. I remember inventing experiments for our conversations. And when I came back to Berkeley, I talked to Leo Postman that we mentioned and described some of these ideas to him, and he was not at all impressed. But we were trying to bring some of the wisdom of the seventh chapter into psychology, and that was an important endeavor that Rappaport was engaged in. So those were, you know, I told you I'm here under false pretenses because I have very few memories. But I've told you most of the memories that came to mind, and I'm happy to answer questions, and you may be able to prompt me about, you know, about that period or anything else that you want to ask me. I'll be happy to answer. So I apologize, but no, don't do that. I haven't earned any applause, but I'll be happy to answer questions. Yes?
So why do you think he didn't make Aliyah?
Why he did not settle in Israel? I don't know. I got the impression that he hadn't been entirely serious about it, and that he was too attached to the work that he was doing here to seriously consider disconnecting himself from this and moving there. So I don't... what wasn't clear to me was why he had come. And he was attached. He was very much a Jew, and that was very significant to him. And I think the idea had some appeal to him. But ultimately, he didn't belong there. And he wouldn't, I don't think he would have been happy there. He was, you know, he didn't quite fit on the American scene because he was so tight, and he would have been a misfit on the Israeli scene with his character. So I'm glad he didn't do it.
Yes. I took a course with him, and I had a rabbi who was so Germanic, and he talked at you, never with you, and he reminded me so much of that rabbi that I sat there with such mixed feelings, because what he was telling me was so interesting and so valuable, and the person who was telling it to me, I was feeling, I didn't like it. And then a little comment on the end of this is that I had come up with some idea that I'd written up a paper on, perfectly good idea, and I thought it was original. And one day I was messing with my notes, something fell out. I opened it up. It was the discussion from the course. And there was that exact conjecture. So my crypt amnesia was of something I had heard from him, but it blocked out, came up as original, my idea.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I mean, that's this sense of discomfort that you're mentioning. But at the same time, as a beneficiary, really, of his generosity and his kindness. I'm going to share with you something that I haven't told anyone, actually. But he made, Rappaport made the biggest compliment I ever got was from him, because I remember sitting there and being completely dumbfounded by it. And he said something that is not in character. You know, I was 23, 24 years old, and he said, I'm awed by you. I'm awed by you. And at first I couldn't, you know, so this is not in character with what we've been saying, and that's, you know, I'm mentioning it because it is so much not in character, you know, for him to come out with it. And I must have looked absolutely, you know, astonished. I wasn't, you know, I couldn't believe what he had said, because it came sort of out of the blue. And he said, and I remember, he said, you heard what I said, you know, in a severe tone. And, you know, so there were those things too. You know, that came from somewhere. And there was a kindness, and I remember that not only to me, but to the other young people. There was a kindness, a wish for them to do well. That was very, very obvious. I think, though, that to be his colleague must have been less fun than to be, you know, clearly his protégé. I think that I would not have wanted to teach with him, I think. Yes.
So, since we have you here, can you elaborate a little bit more on how being here, studying with Rappaport, being at Briggs, studying the Chapter 7 in such precise detail, how that affected your thinking, your work, your theories?
You know, I don't think people know where their ideas come from. And so, you know, you've reported on having an idea and then finding it in your notes. I really didn't know when I came up with those ideas about attention as effort, that effort and cathexis were really, you know, closely related. I got to it seemingly as an inevitable result of doing something entirely different. I studied the size of the pupil when people think and when they solve problems and when they memorize things. And the pupil is a measure of mental effort. And that led me that we could follow mental effort by a physiological index second by second. So that led me to a theory of effort. And I did not realize that I was studying cathexis until very late. And I have never known, you know, what was the role of that experience. What there was, the interaction with Rappaport as a person and as an intellectual, and that mixture of intellectual rigor with a semi-religious attitude to the whole enterprise, and you know, it very much like Jewish learning, you know, that was throughout, which is a mix of an intellectual and a religious experience. That was certainly, you know, very impressive, also unique in my experience. I mean, he really was not like other people, you know. I've met serious people, but I've never met someone who had that particular mix of religion and rigor.
The way, if you there, to fill in some of your description, not so long ago, the letters between Rappaport and Bob Holt were published, and by international, I forget, Arnold Richards journal or company, and the qualities you describe are profoundly there in the writing.
Yeah.
I mean, if I got a letter like that, I think I'd stop writing and I'd stop thinking. They're so austere, they're right, they pull no punches.
Yeah.
And in a funny way, they're not cruel, because he's giving you the respect of telling you exactly what he's thinking, rather than either empty praise or unfair criticism. And all of us here know Bob Holt. He's now 101. And I think it's worth noting that he responded just that way. He never acted hurt. He never was petulant, and so on. And the other incident that involves Bob Holt, the primary opponent during that era of actuarial versus clinical prediction was Robert Holt.
Yes.
And
he is the one who responded to Paul Meehl.
He was the one who responded to Paul Meehl. So in a way, he was picking up Rappaport's battle,
yes,
his likes and dislikes. And by the way, it would be wonderful, I think, to ask Bob what he thinks about the verdict of history that Meehl was right and he was wrong, essentially.
Oh, I mean, yeah, there is no question about the verdict of history on that particular issue. Meehl was right.
I don't think many people in this room accept that, by the way.
You know, that is a conversation I'm quite willing to have if anybody wants to enter into it. It's something I know something about.
Yes.
Done the work on biases, and you've really established that there are widespread. You surveyed statisticians who you think would be logical and come to the right statistical answer, but they had the same biases as lay people. And then there's Paul Meehl on actuarial versus clinical judgment. And we tend to think, well, all these other people have biases, and we're rational actors if we do this. So I'd like your observation about how these biases have affected the development of the field of psychology in general, and clinical psychology specifically. How have we been kind of influenced by our own biases?
I'd like to pick up on Meehl more than on biases, because in fact those were two quite separate developments. I mean, I was strongly influenced by Meehl in a very direct way. But there are several points of overlap. So Meehl wrote, and I recommend to those who don't like the idea of Meehl, read a few of his papers, because he wrote beautifully. And he has a paper called Why I Don't Go to Case Conferences that I think every clinician owes it to himself or herself to read.
I assign it to every class.
Good. I mean, you're a man after my heart. On the issue of clinical judgment and what we have learned, and I would say that one of the major lessons that we have learned about thinking and about judgment in the intervening years is something about confidence. And it is that confidence is not a good guide to accuracy. The correlation between subjective confidence and accuracy is low. And it is true, we know where correct intuitions come from. And we really can trace it, and we have a pretty good idea where they come from. And correct intuitions come with a lot of confidence. You know something, you don't know why you know it. That's a definition of intuition. You don't exactly know why you know it, but you're sure you know it. But that is also true when you don't really know it. So if you, it's not that you know and you don't know why you know it. You think you know and you don't know why you think you know it. And that is the fact that you can have intuitions that are completely incorrect. In fact, they express biases, and you can trace them, and you can understand them. And you can have them with complete confidence. That, I think, it's an important lesson. It's this really issue. And it's clear that it's a very difficult lesson to internalize, because confidence, it feels like perception. It feels like I know it, I see it, I can see it, I can feel it, it's just immediate, I know it. And the idea that you can have that feeling and it's actually not based on reality, that it's false, that it's something, it's a story that you're telling yourself, it's a story that your brain has invented for you. This is the fundamental thing. One of the fundamental things that have happened. And clearly that is something I would say that Rappaport did not know. That is, he had so much confidence in his own judgment, clinical and statistical and you name it. If he thought of something, he had been so rigorous and so careful that he was completely confident. And so the idea that somebody could do trivial, empty, stupid statistical work and be stronger than clinical judgment, then his response to that was, this is not real clinical judgment. So clinical judgment is something else, and you're not touching it. Now, the intervening decades have really not been kind to that point of view. There have been, since Neil's book, about 300 studies comparing people's judgments to very simple rules, combinatorial, additive rules. And in about half of the cases, the rules beat the judgments of people outright. And about the other half is mostly ties. There are very few, if any, cases in which clinical judgment actually beat the rules to which it was compared. So this is something that people, I think, really have to accept. This is what evidence is saying.
Lots of luck.
I know. I think I understand. But because I'm telling you not to believe your own eyes and not to believe your own confidence. And you're not going to believe me. I'm taking that for granted. I'm assuming that. It would be very surprising if anybody, that's because, that's another thing that we have learned. we think that we believe in things because we have reasons to believe them. And that is demonstrably an illusion. So we believe in things, and then, you know, when we need reasons, they come to mind. But the reasons come later. And the belief and the confidence in the belief, that comes first. And frequently the conclusions come first, and the decisions come first, and the rest follows. And it's not rationalization. This is all there is. It's reasons.
By the way, what you just described is profoundly psychoanalytic.
I know. It's psychoanalytic, but, you know, but it applies to me. It doesn't apply only to others. It applies to my beliefs, because that's what put in question.
What if we have full confidence intuitively that you're correct?
You may have it, but I don't think that it will overcome. When you are wrong about something, you'll be confidently wrong, and nothing that I tell you is going to change that, because I know, and you know, I've been studying this for more than half a century, and nothing has happened to me. And my intuitions are just the way they were, pretty much.
You know what's striking about Rappaport's dislike of Paul Meehl? He was so appreciative of intelligence. And Paul Meehl is, without question, probably the smartest psychologist in the last in the last 75 years. So the depths of Rappaport's distaste for this issue overcame what would normally be tremendous admiration for a mind of a Paul Meehl.
You know, a mind of a Paul Meehl, who was a psychoanalyst, a practicing psychoanalyst, and who came up with all that research. So, but there was, you know, for Rappaport, believing or accepting Meehl would have been to reject everything that he really believed in. That was fundamental, and he couldn't.
As it turns out, Bob Hope had great respect for Paul Meehl.
Oh, he did. No question about
it. Affection and respect for Paul Meehl.
Yeah,
absolutely. They were friendly opponents.
Yeah, I mean the respect showed. And by the way, Meehl was quite respectful. Also, I mean, and you know, he knew. I mean, he was a clinician, so he knew all of this. It's quite an interesting story.
It is.
Yes.
I knew Paul Meehl pretty well when I was a student, and I think it should be said that the reason for the clinical versus statistical work that Meehl did was not because it was suited his intuition, that he would have resisted if he had been wrong. I think he would have turned over in a minute if the data had come out differently. And the reason was that you had a responsibility to some patient. In other words, he took crazy guesses about what kinds of research topics his intuition told him would pay off. Working on latent clinical taxa without an accepted criterion. No one thinks this is going anywhere. He persisted in it. His intuition said, I'm right, I'm going to stay with it. If everyone doesn't join in, I will still go ahead. I will be right or I will be wrong. But with the clinical versus statistical prediction, someone is going to get hurt. And I remember his saying that when he made referrals, often got requests from the community for referrals, he said he had a notebook at his desk, and he wrote down the kind of patient, aggressive adolescent female, referral to this person. And he would follow up in a year, and did the therapy go well? And if it's not going well, we'll keep track. And I'm not sending cases like this to people who were not successful with it. So, it didn't have anything to do with ego. It wasn't about being right. It was about doing your job. And the whole Minnesota multiphasic project and all of that stuff was about getting the services to people who need them, and we're in better shape than they. So I'm sure Meehl would have turned over in a moment if the data...
Absolutely. But I think Meehl could have turned because he had both sides in him. He was the clinician. And Emile was very proud of his work. I mean, that it, you know, it was the highlight of his career, and he was very proud of it. But he was in service of the data, there is no question, completely. The clinicians had a harder time accepting, because he was really striking at the core, at a core belief that you can trust your clinical intuition. And by the way, I think you can. So I want to correct some of the things that, some of the impressions that I may have corrected. There are certain things that people are very good at, and clinical intuition could very well be one of them. A trivial example that I always give in that context is that we all have expertise, and with expertise comes expert intuition, this immediate recognition. And we all have expertise, for example, in our spouse's wife, voice. So everybody who has been married or who has had a long-term partner knows that one word on the telephone, and you know the person's state of mind, and you're not wrong. You know, you're completely confident and you're right. You know, you can take that to the bank. Now, my impression has always been, not always, but since I've been thinking about it, my impression has been for a while that in the immediate clinical situation, in the interaction with the patient, there probably is a great deal of absolutely valid intuition. What there isn't is the ability to forecast the future. So you can understand what's going on in the moment. You can respond in the moment. And that gives you complete confidence that you understand the person. But in fact, that doesn't enable you to predict much about the person's future. And that's the dichotomy. So, and that, I think, explains in part, you know, why it's so difficult for people to admit that their intuitions cannot be trusted. Because in fact, your intuitions can be trusted in the clinical hour. It's just the predictions, the long-term judgments that people are not equipped to do. That simple rules aggregating information do better than people. And the idea that I feel equally confident in two domains, and in one domain I'm proved right, because in the clinical interaction you also are making short-term predictions and they're verified. And so you get that sense that you know what you're doing, you know, like a ping pong player knows what he's doing. And he acts and he reacts, and it's, there's validity in there. That the idea that you can have that much confidence here and it's justified, and in a task that looks closely related, like predicting what's going to happen to that patient, that is something you cannot do, that's very difficult to accept, I think.
Do you know who gives the best example I've ever read of that? Paul Meehl. And I remember the example. It's the same Paul Meehl who writes about, tells the following account about his own experience. He walking to his analyst's office, and he sees a couple come out of a hospital, and they're crying. They look very sad. And he's convinced that their daughter is very ill, terribly ill, and they just can't bear it. And he starts crying in the middle of the street. And he goes to his analyst's office, and he's still teary. And the analyst asks him, did you have an unpleasant interaction with your daughter in which you scolded her this morning? And suddenly the crying stops. The overwhelming depression lifts. And of course, that's exactly what happened. So that's a lovely
example. That's a beautiful story.
Example,
yeah.
Comes from,
yeah,
Meehl. Isn't,
yeah,
that interesting?
Yeah, I mean, so he had.
He was an extraordinary capacity for these sorts of, when something was real, he told about it. But undefensible predictions, he.
So,
you're wrong.
Yeah, I hope I have qualified enough, you know, with, you know, when I'm saying what Meehl has proved, and that's you can see both sides, and you can clearly understand how it happened. You know why people cannot accept that meal is right, because in their daily work, they constantly get proof that he was wrong. You know, if you don't understand it properly. Yes.
I think nothing could have brought home more powerfully your point that we can trust our clinical intuition in the moment, but we can't necessarily predict in the anecdotes of the suicide.
Yes.
Because there is actually a research project, and I don't know whether that was artfully done. It seemed very artfully done as you went on talking. I was thinking, well, this is the living example, of course. And there is a project here at Riggs which shows that many people who make suicide attempts have not told their therapist that they were going to do it. And the therapist, it was blindsided by this. So I'm just wondering, what happened in that case conference? You were an observer, you were a student. Was there any reflection on that? Was there?
I mean, you know, that was what was overwhelming, was that when people described that patient, it looked almost criminal that she hadn't been stopped, because there were people saying, I met her on the stairs. I mean, I remember this. I met her on the stairs and she looked odd to me. And I was wondering whether to intervene. So there was, you know, there was a lot of that, but we do know about hindsight. And so all of this was colored by the fact that they knew. But the evening before, I mean, that's, you know, that's the failure of prediction. We all had that material. And nobody, you know, got up and said, oh, this woman is in danger. You know, let's save her. That didn't happen. So, it was, for me, it made that point about the limitations of the ability to predict what people will do. Yes?
I'm sorry. On the point of personal communication, personal transmission of ideas, did you have contact with Emil as you had with Rappaport, or did you only know him through his work?
Well, I had an article reviewed by Neil, and he signed his review, and you know, and he published my article, and it still gives me the shivers. So I was quite impressed. But there was an additional story about Neil that I, when I got the Nobel Prize, I was interviewed a fair amount, and people were asking me who were my heroes and my influences, and I mentioned Paul Neil as one of the people who had shaped my thinking. And a few years ago, I got a letter from Paul Neil's widow. It turns out that he was dying at the time. But he was told of that story. And he was told that somebody who had just gotten the Nobel had, and she wrote in very touching ways of how moved he was. And he told her that he felt as if he had gotten it himself. It was a very touching, very, very, very touching letter. Wow. So that was Paul Neil. Yes?
Let me bring another issue about clinical inference, not so much clinical judgment, but clinical inference, and our ability as clinicians, based on interacting with patients, to be able to infer developmental issues that have organized personality. Now, I think that's not prediction, but it's an inference based both on countless interactions where you're getting information. For example, that somebody has difficulty in opening up, that you don't feel you're in contact with them, and then you can find out from their history that there really wasn't anybody there that was there available for them when they were distressed and they were ignored. You can make a pretty, in my experience, a pretty good clinical inference that this organizing principle, that not exposing vulnerabilities, plays a major role in the patient.
Here I would be skeptical. So here there's clearly, I would tell a completely different story about this. That I would tell the story that we're very, very good at telling stories. and that we construct stories spontaneously that make sense of what we see. And that once we have a story, it has a life of its own, and it makes it very difficult for us to construct a new story. And that the stability of the stories we tell ourselves, the stability we take as evidence for the validity of the stories, there is an alternative way of explaining it in which the story just maintains itself. And the evidence for, I'm not making a specific judgment about any clinical judgment. I mean, some inferences are true, but inferences can be false and can be held with enormous confidence.
There's also a more formal reason for why that would be not trustworthy, and that's what was it, Larry Kohlberg or Crossley, I forget, what they call follow-back versus follow-up data. The people you're seeing who had such and such experience are already being seen by a therapist. The people who have those experiences and who don't develop in that manner, you'll never see. So your theories are based entirely on follow-back data, and that's a powerful reason for being skeptical about clinical inferences that are based on clinical data, because you're not dealing with the thousands of people who had the same abuse, the same experience, but don't become borderline or don't come to your office, and that's a powerful factor that limits the validity.
Yes?
Isn't it interesting that persons can be so rational and cognitive like Rutherford was, and at the same time so religious, and other persons can be so sensual and intuitive like Erickson was, and at the same time so religious skeptic?
You can tell stories that will make them very coherent, both of them. They felt like very coherent people. There was something about Rapoport, about the austerity, about the sense that he was in the presence of something that was bigger than he was, which really you got when you were with Rapoport. There he was, there you were, and he was large and you were small, and there was that thing that was so much larger than he was, and that were the truth or Freud or, and that was a very powerful. Yes?
I want to go back to Maurizio's point, and not talking longitudinally, but before you can count things, before you can count patterns, you have to categorize them. And that requires kind of intuition. So there's a process that is scientific, but on a different level, that makes the category. And then you can count them after. But I think that part of what you're getting at is what the process, and Maurizio, I don't know if this is picking up on, that what you're experiencing as you confront different people showing a similar pattern is the making of a category.
As a cognitive psychologist, I would be skeptical of this. That is, I would say, I would say that our ability to create categories, our ability to create accounts, our ability to create coherence out of virtually nothing is almost unlimited. It's the major characteristic. And the ability to see patterns, we see patterns where there are not. And, we are designed that way. We're designed to detect patterns when they are barely visible, and in fact, when they're not there. Yes?
It's part of your making a big distinction between affect and reason. And there's a whole set of processing that goes on, that was on this interface of affect and reason, that gives you something that's not, and you're saying it's irrational, but affect is not necessarily there.
No, I'm not. I haven't said that. By the way, I never use the word irrational, almost never, except to say that I don't use it. So, I don't draw a sharp distinction. I'd like to do one thing that has nothing to do with Rappaport, but it has something to do with the kind of stuff that I do for a living. So I'll give you perhaps my favorite example of something that I think we understand, and it's a prediction, and how a prediction gets made. And I've written up that story, some of you might recognize it, so I had the story, and it's about Julie, and Julie is a graduating senior at a university. And I'll tell you one fact about Julie, which is that she read fluently when she was 4 years old. She read fluently when she was 4 years old. And I'm asking you, what is her grade point average? And the striking thing is, and I'm, you can check it, but every one of you has a number. So I asked that question, a number came to your mind. Furthermore, I have a pretty good idea what that number is. It's not very far from 3.7 on a scale of 4. It's just not very far. Now, how do I know? Because I know what happened. So this is a mechanism that I know. So you're told she read when she was 4 years old. That gives you a sense of how precocious she was. And that sense is on some sort of intensity scale or percentile scale. You can locate her in the distribution, and she would have been more precocious if she had read fluently when she was 2.5 years old, but 4 years old, she is precocious. The GPA that comes to your mind has the same percentile. So what you're doing is you're translating age 4 into a percentile, and then you're finding the GPA that matches that percentile, and that's the number that comes to your mind, and you're not aware of anything. This is the number, and we know that that's the process because we know that those percentiles match. So we do understand. There is a way of studying intuition that gives you, this is one of the few things that I'm very sure about. I mean, most of the things I'm much less sure about than that. But you can know facts, and that's based on a lot of research, and I can make a prediction that you probably recognize as applying to you. And in that sense, psychology has made some progress, since those days.
But what was that her GPA?
I beg your pardon?
What was her GPA? Just because
I can tell you what the best guess about her GPA would be. Yeah. That I can tell you. Probably around 3.3. And roughly. And that's for the following reason. I mean, this is now statistics. This is because if you knew nothing about Julie, your best guess is the average of GPA, which is probably around 3.2. Now, you know a fact that makes her better, but how much can you tell about graduating GPA from the age at which you read? Not much. So you make a small adjustment upward from the average, and that's how you get to around 3.3. That's the best guess.
But it is a guess.
Of course, I mean, I don't know. Julie is a creature of my mind. I don't know her GPA.
There's a famous story, I don't know if it's apocryphal, about Jerome Bruner, incredibly smart man also. He was giving a talk and showing data on a graph and drawing a conclusion, a story. And his research assistant says, Dr. Bruner, and he pushes him away, and he says, finally he gets his attention. He says, you've reversed the graph. So Bruner says, even more interesting. That's the story.
Yeah, it's a good, I knew Jerry Bruner. Yep, it's a good story about him, yes. Yes.
When you speak to other groups as compared to a group of psychologists, and you tell them maybe that their predictive abilities or the way they make their decisions are not what they thought, do they have the same, or do they react with equal resistance? And,
or differently? They,
yeah, do they seem more open or excited to hear that
I mean, they feel mostly, you know, people don't feel that I'm talking about them.
Right.
They feel that I'm talking about somebody else. Whereas here, I think people feel that I'm talking about you. And that's a big difference. So when I talk to, you know, executives, and I tell them about executives, you get the same, you get the same pain. It's that's part of the game. Yes.
What are your thoughts about the will?
Are you sure that we should? That, I have no interesting thoughts about the will. I really have no real thoughts about the will. And you can ask me about consciousness, and I will tell you the same thing. That, you know, there are certain topics I know I don't understand. And I would think about the will as an experience. I would not think about it, you know, as something real. I would think about the experience of willing things, and we can talk about that. But
you know, that's what Rappaport says, the same thing. He writes that for analysts, the issue of free will is of little interest. What matters is whether you experience yourself as an agent who has free will or whether you do not. And one is healthier than the other. End of story.
That's beautiful. That's account. Right. Yeah.
That's Rappaport's account of the issue of free will.
For and, yeah, I would, that's roughly where I would be. Yeah. Yes.
I was trying to think of the name of the two people who did the study. It was in Switzerland, where they asked a psychiatrist to interview suicide, people who committed and made a suicide attempt, and to make a prediction based on the interview whether they would make another attempt. And they videoed the face of the psychiatrist. And the predictions they made were no better than chance. But the facial expressions were a better predictor than the now, obviously, they didn't access their subjective experience while they were doing the interview. So when we talk about intuition, are we also talking about the extent to which the person accesses their own subjective experience to go into it, or is it just a cognitive?
You know, my first reaction to this is that I doubt the story.
You doubt?
Yes. Yes, I doubt the study. No, and I'll explain why I doubt the study.
Okay.
You would need, in order to make that point, you cannot make that point on interviewing two patients or even 20. It's the kind of statistical analysis that you need, the kind of data that you need in order to say they were not able to do this, but their facial expressions knew. Which, by the way, I'm quite willing to believe it is true, but I'm not willing to accept the study as you described it. I mean, I know how difficult it would be to prove that hypothesis, you know, in a way that would make me believe it. And this is because it turns out, I'm now studying how psychologists think about psychology, and it turns out that our ability, and I'm not talking about academic psychologists, our overconfidence is extreme. Our belief in our data is wildly exaggerated. Our belief in our conclusions, our belief in our hypotheses, we are way overconfident, and I'm struggling with this because this means me, this means I, and you know, and I'm having difficulty. But that study, it's plausible, it's possible. I doubt it. Excuse me, but you see where I come from.
The power you would need statistically.
What?
The power you would need statistically.
Yeah, the power you need. For this hypothesis, you know, if I think of what study you would need to run in order to be convinced that this is true, I can tell you this is a very difficult study to prove. And having a few psychiatrists interview a few patients is not enough. Yes.
Also, the likelihood is that the correlation is so low that it probably accounts for 10 or 11% of the variable.
Yeah, and then, which means that you'd need a lot of evidence. I think I'm boring people.
No?
You know, because...
Are we boring you?
No, you're not boring me. Not boring me. You know, I like talking. You can, and I'm quite comfortable, but I just don't want to bore you. So, yeah.
It's interesting with the suicide, because I would think that that would be potentially the one area where psychologists would feel relief about the lack of, you know, clinical predictive ability in their own person. But it doesn't seem that way necessarily.
They would feel relief because it relieves them of responsibility.
Right. You would think that that would be like one situation where they would feel, you know.
No, I mean, this was really not what happened. I mean, there was a terrible sense on that occasion of, you know, we missed it, we blew it, there was a sense that a grave error had been made and no one could put his finger on it, because I think no error had been made.
I have one question that in your book and in today, your comments, the emphasis, of course, has been on the unreliability of intuitions and so on. But, of course, the other part of the book, Thinking Slow and Thinking Fast, is the possible role corrective factors and of the deliberative reasoning. And it's interesting, we have focused only on the former and very little on the latter, namely, what kind of correctives do you think would be most interesting to a group like us? Effort-filled control, deliberative reasoning,
well,
delay, whatever, ego functions and all that.
It's slowing down is really the only advice that I have been able to give is slowing down. And you mentioned the word delay, and that's interesting to me. The best advice that I think comes out of, you know, what we know on this is that you want eventually to have an intuition, but you want to delay it as much as possible. So the problem with intuitions is that they come very fast. And so here, that's a story, part of my life story, is that I set up the interviewing system in the Israeli army. I set it up when I was 22 years old, and it's in force to this day, and I'm 85. I mean, it was in force a few years ago when I last checked. And the essence of the interviewing system in the Israeli army, which I created after reading Paul Meehl, so that's, you know, that just to complete the story, I did that in 56, and my boss made me read Paul Meehl. The essence of it is that instead of trying to figure out how good a soldier this recruit is, you don't think about that. You force the interviewer to rate the interviewee on 6 separate dimensions, and you think about those dimensions one at a time, and you collect the evidence and you score each dimension. And after that,
Thank you,
John. You can have. Now, I can tell you the story, because there is a story associated with that. So I was 22 years old, but the interviewers were 21 years old, and I told them what to do. And I said, you run that interview. You collect those six things. And they were furious with me. And you can see why. They were saying, you're turning us into robots. We want to, basically, we want to exercise our clinical intuitions, and you're not letting us. And so, as a compromise, I said, well, you know, you do it my way. But when you're done with the six, when you're done with the six traits, no, that's the compromise is coming now. When you're done with the six traits, I said, close your eyes. How good a soldier will that recruit be? And put down a number between 1 and 5. Now, 50 years later, well, I should say, a few months later, we knew the results. And the results were that that intuitive judgment given at the end was as good as the average of the six, and was adding information. So that the ends, you know, we ended up with a formula that had the average of the six ratings, and with equal weight, that rating given at the end. So what lesson do I draw from this? Intuition is wonderful. You want to delay it. You want to delay it until you have all the information, because otherwise the intuition will get in your way of collecting additional information. And delaying intuition is really, I think, a good idea.
But was it intuition if they had the information of the first six rings?
Yes.
No, I mean, the...
Wasn't it...
They were already influenced by
here,
the ratings.
Of course. Of course, that's the idea. But what you did with the ratings, you collected the ratings independently of each other. So there were separate questions for each rating, which were objective and factual. And then, so intuition played, global intuition didn't have a chance to be, to form until the end. But we tried to delay it as much as possible. I should add, 50 years later, I went back to my unit. You know, I'd gotten the Nobel Prize, so I was for a while a minor celebrity in Israel, and I visited my unit and I talked to the commander, and she was telling me how they're interviewing people, and then she said, and then we tell them, close your eyes. So that this expression had stayed for 50 years. So, okay.
So wasn't the global judgment an implicit averaging of the first six?
No, because it added information. It was valid in the, you know, beyond the six. That it added information, valuable information.
I'm worried that we're tiring you too much.
No, I mean, I think we're done, aren't we?
But no, but not because of that, because we don't want to...
No, I mean, I'm not, you know, I have adrenaline, it's not, but it's too long.
Okay.
We've been going on long enough. So, one, if there is one additional question, I'll take it, but if not, I think we're done. We're done.